And this panel discussion will just take the format of people asking questions. You can either ask a question of a particular person or of the panel generally. And I guess it doesn't matter who you ask. Any of the panel is welcome to join in. Perhaps I might start with one question to Anthony. It's almost the reverse of the most recent question. With all these guarantees, are you able to give us any sort of feel for the costs? And I might give an example in Australia. I think one of the reasons why there's no guaranteed annuity products in Australia is the costs are seen as very high. It's many years since I was even able to get a quote, but going back many years when I compared the cost of an annuity product for a 60 or 65-year-old compared to what I thought best estimate assumptions would give, the cost was at least 30%, which of course is huge, and I suspect if that exercise was done now, it might even be more. But can you give any examples of costs of guarantees in any of the areas you've described?
I can certainly give you examples of what companies are charging for the guarantees. Now, some analysis that we've done suggests that a lot of the guarantees are, I mean, let's politely call them loss leaders. And so, I mean, for example, some of the U.S. variable annuities, the charges might be somewhere, the charge on the base might be somewhere between 1% and 1.5%, and then one of the living benefit guarantees, like a withdrawal benefit, might be another 45 to 50 basis points. Now, that guarantee, if you try to sort of market to market, do a market consistent valuation of that guarantee, the cost might be more like 55 to 60 basis points. But you're still making a decent profit on the base, on the carrier policy. And, you know, like all of these things, if bundling the additional benefit helps you sell more of the base product, then, you know, that, so if you look at the overall profitability, it's still quite healthy. But things like, you know, the Five for Life product is, you know, that's quite important. 5% for the rest of your life is probably the minimum that I think customers would be prepared to kind of accept as an income, minimum income stream. So there is going to be challenges going forwards if, you know, volatility increases or if interest rates do fall, in actually maintaining the attractiveness of those products.
It occurred to me that I think one comment was made that the problem of developing and marketing new products in this area is made very, very difficult because of the number and complexity of government rules and regulations in respect of everything under the sun. I wondered if the people and firms concerned with the developing new products in this area had in fact discussed with government on the basis that A, if there were attractive new products developed and available and marketed from the private sector, that it wouldn't necessarily only benefit the fat cats who have so much money that they're sort of outside the government's area of concern, but it could generally make a more substantial contribution from people who would make use of private sector products, and so some of the extra costs of government that we've seen foreshadowed might in fact be reduced, and so there'd be a case for people from the private sector getting together with bureaucrats and others from different parts of the government machine to try and find ways of reducing the complexity from the government side, which would facilitate the development of a wider range of potentially attractive products for all people.
Should I start with that one? Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that there is a strong awareness of that within government already. We certainly have had discussions with the government. They are very aware of that issue. It's not a will to help that's the issue. It's just the logistics of it, the timing, the number of people from different places that need to be involved, all that sort of stuff. The changes the government has recently made are helpful, I think, for innovation. There are still some question marks around the actual words that go into the legislation, which could help or hinder, and we've certainly engaged with government on that perspective. And I would say there is definitely a goodwill and a good understanding of the need to get this right. It's just a matter of the practicalities and the logistics.
I might, like, just to add to that too, I think one of the areas, like, disclosure is really important, but I remember talking to someone from ASIC on, you know, when all the new PDSs were coming out, and they were saying how good it would be that people could now, like, catch a train home and easily compare four products, you know, on the way home until you actually work out that if you've got four complete PDSs and supplementary PDSs and insurance PDSs and investment PDSs, you'd be carrying a pile like that big on the train home. And so I think the problem is that just that lack of, you know, that over-prescription that unfortunately government tends to revert to at times. Mm.
Okay. Well, just before the panel discussion started, there was an animated discussion, so I think provoked by a question from you, Kathy. Would you like to share that this time?
Okay. I've got two questions, really, for Pauline. And one was what views they came to as sort of likelihood of selection risk with the longevity side of the product. And the other was, and I didn't get to ask it because we got so involved in that debate, but the other one was, are you only ever going to have one pool so people don't get a chance to sort of check out how healthy people are in the different pools?
We do need to be careful with moral hazard on this product. So we won't be sending our customer list to the other customers, I can tell you that much. The longevity selection risk is reduced compared to a normal immediate annuity because the annuity payments don't actually start for 20 years. So people opt into this product and then don't get any income out of it for 20 years. That gives us a chance to watch the mortality on the pool, and it also breaks a nexus between the deciding to enter and your own state of health at that point in time. In respect of more than one pool, this has been hotly debated. I can't tell you how long we've debated this for, and the theorists go, we need... You know, to have absolute equity, we need almost one person per pool. Well, then you go, hang on, then we've got no insurance. So you go back the other way. And to optimise insurance and efficiency, et cetera, we want as few pools as possible. The moment we currently have three pools, which are actually based on different asset mixes. Theoretically, from a theoretically pure perspective, I don't think that's a very good outcome because I think what that's driving people to do is actually invest more conservatively than they probably should be for the period that we have. But anyway, they wanted the choice, so we've given them the choice. Other than that, I think we'll wait and see how it goes. At the moment, the longevity boost allocation mechanism does allow for some variances in populations, so between male and female and different ages, etc. If we do find that different cohorts start to experience significant different mortality shapes, then it may be that we will need to set up separate pools, but that will be balanced against the critical mass that you need to get the pooling effect to work and the size of the pools as we go forward.
Just a quick one, Pauline. It's Kevin O'Sullivan. What's the withdrawal terms if I buy an annuity and I want to get my money back in 10 years? Can I?
During the establishment phase, it's return of premium, partial return of premium. So if you expect to be in the establishment phase for 20 years, you withdraw after 10, you get essentially half your premium back, less some fees.
Yes. Andrew Gale, question for Pauline. One of the challenges, Pauline, I guess, with the sort of the pooling risk type products and the sort of the implied premium for it, I guess, is just the marketability and how you get that out through distribution channels and the like. Would you like to comment in terms of the early experience, how you found that in terms of traction in the market and the sort of issues emerging from that?
It's been so diverse, I can't tell you. It's been amazing. As I said, literally, we've had people who say, I could sell this if I had a full death benefit, and you're like, well, then what are you actually selling? And then we've had others who are like, fantastic, let me add it. It does take time. It absolutely takes time. And the experience that we've had is the it's complicated. The AFSLs are leaping at it and are actually coming to us asking for it to be put on the approved product list at a greater rate than we expected. It's taking probably longer than we expected to get down to the individual advisors' hearts and minds engaged to get them to understand it. But as we're sending out illustration software and we're letting planners play with it, they're actually coming up with strategies that we hadn't thought of for this and for tying it in with the way the age pension works, and that's really exciting to see. So I think it depends. There will be some people that it will just be too hard for, but others, particularly the more sophisticated end of the market, will find ways to use it and take it forward in a way that we hadn't even pictured.
So can I just add to that one based on experience overseas for similar products? I guess maybe it's fairly obvious that these types of products are much easier to sell if you actually control distribution. I think a lot of the successful companies in Europe and North America are the ones that have either have a good control over their distribution, therefore they can be very targeted in the way that they educate, or they have very, very strong distribution support services. And so actually, and this is typical in North America, where it is very much product-based rather than advice-based, the agent will almost, as soon as they get a sniff of a sale in this type of thing, they'll be on the phone to the provider saying, here's the circumstances, what should I sell them? And the distribution support at the manufacturer, at the provider, is extremely strong. And they're almost advising through the financial planner out to the end customer. I've seen one call center at work, and they were extremely impressive in the way that they were able to grasp the end customer's requirements, find the right combination of products, advise the advisor as to how to sell it on to the end customer, and really, you know, all you're doing there is you're still controlling the distribution, but you're just sort of doing that at an earlier point in the process.
John Moroney, a question for both Anthony and Pauline, and it's really looking at the way the risk management framework sort of apply sort of conceptually, probably for Anthony, at the sort of global level. I heard you advocating there a need to really tie in an integrated approach to what are the risks that each new product in this area is really bringing on, what are the potentials for hedging that, and what are the various sort of implications, and really for Pauline, did that sort of become an issue, particularly in working through the Australian regulatory framework? There's more focus from the regulators on what are the risk management implications for anything. This is a fairly small addition to the balance sheet now. Presumably the risk will be greater in 20 years, but were there some lessons sort of in how to deal with the risk management sort of analysis and reporting? So,
yeah, I'll start with maybe the more conceptual side of things. It really is a big requirement for this type of product, is not only to have the systems in place to understand the risk, but also to have the governance processes to have a very clear message from the top down as to how much risk as a company we're prepared to take on, what types of risks we're prepared to take on, how these risks interact with other risks, so all of the whole diversification issue. That's extremely important, and that has huge systems implications. It has huge expertise implications, and it also requires, if you're actually going to do dynamic hedging or dynamic reinsurance of some of the biometric risks, requires much faster data transfer and data accumulation and processing than a lot of companies have. The advantage that we're starting to see in, say, Europe is as regulators are moving more towards pure economic-based solvency regulation. So the Swiss are already there. The FSA in the UK is already there. Solvency II is going to happen 2010 or thereabouts. There's then much greater alignment between the regulatory view of risk and the economic view of risk. And that sort of removes one of the dimensions out of the problem. But certainly what we're finding in the US in particular is companies have still got a number of dimensions to the risk question. There's the gap earnings volatility. There's the C3 phase 2 solvency regulation, which is kind of economic, but not completely. Then you've got those more advanced companies that have actually moved onto an economic basis internally. So you've got a whole bunch of conflicting requirements that you need to somehow process through your risk management area and come up with some kind of optimal hedging strategy or trading strategy. So, yeah, it's a much bigger requirement than what most companies are used to.
From our perspective, it was largely risk management that drove the end product design, basically risk management, a trade-off between risk management and what the market was after. Where we started was providing a whole heap of guarantees and that kind of thing, and we quickly worked out that we were planning on providing a guaranteed immediate annuity at the point of conversion, pricing at that point. We quickly worked out if everything worked out, we'd have the biggest immediate annuity book in the company, in the country, and who knows how much capital behind that, certainly more capital than would be available to us. So that was why we went back to the variable annuity at that point in time. I think the way we've packaged it up, most of the risks do go back to the customer. They go back on a pooled basis, so it's easier for each customer to bear and each customer has a lower risk profile, but they're not sitting with the company, and we did that for risk management reasons. We then, just before we launched, we went to APRA. We thought we should get them comfortable with the concept. And it was quite, it was an interesting meeting. They initially were of the opinion, okay, here we go. Somebody else taking on risk they don't understand they're taking on, and we'll just have to point out where it is they've missed the risk and they can go away and think about that. They didn't say that, but and I can understand them thinking that because I think there's been a lot of product innovations in this space where that's exactly what's happened. The company has taken on risk it didn't understand it was taking on. And it was interesting as that meeting evolved, watching them throw up all the questions and actually running through how we'd mitigated each of the risks. And I think that certainly made them feel very comfortable. It made me feel very comfortable too that we'd had peer review, that we had thought about most all of the risks and the way that we were dealing with them.
I'll just add something to that, if I can, on the longevity side of things, and you know, something that we're discussing up here earlier. There really is a vast difference in the understanding of longevity risk across different industries, and maybe not surprisingly, the UK is probably the most sophisticated because we've got compulsory annuitisation. And there are some people in the UK who've got very, very complex driver-based models around longevity who are actually not just producing different scenarios, but actually producing sort of outcomes driven by medical events and so on. So there's a few models that have got some kind of predictive, if we find a cure for heart disease in the next 5 years, then this is what's going to happen to population mortality and longevity. And as a result of that, there's a lot more sophistication around and things like the longevity bonds and the huge burgeoning market in pension liability transfers that's just come out of nowhere in the UK. Because companies have now realised that actually longevity is a nice diversifying risk for a lot of particularly investment banks who have got a lot of asset risk on their books. They can get longevity risk for about 5% of the standalone capital requirement because it just diversifies so nicely against all of their other risks. Not only that, it gives a nice stable funding base to do something innovative on the asset side. So all of a sudden, you know, what used to be seen as very toxic 5 years ago is now seen as a great risk to get into because it actually provides all sorts of benefits. And at the same time, you've got corporates who don't want to be a large pension scheme with a small manufacturing operation on the side. You know, they actually want to be able to focus on their core business. So, you know, it is actually a win-win situation.
Yes, Alan.
Alan Merton. I want to go back to some of the earlier discussions and some of the charts that I think were put up about where the money actually is, and I guess we're talking about what lies ahead for wealth managers. A lot of the reverse mortgage providers are actually non-bank institutions, and most of the wealth managers are not in reverse mortgages. The reverse mortgages and other vehicles seem to be an early means of actually getting at what appears to be the major chunk of assets that most retirees have, which is the home. I'm interested in comments from the panel, maybe Anthony from overseas, but Michael and Kathy as well, about other options that you see to actually get access to that money, not just pull it out to keep it for later, but to actually get access to it earlier and use it effectively.
Yes, there's a couple of aspects there, I think. Like, if we just get back to reverse mortgages, I think there is a pricing risk with a lot of them. And I think Michael really might have referred to this, that I think a lot of the providers aren't used to providing that talk. It's a back-end loss product, you know, and they think that the 1% interest margin that they're charging over normal interest rates is like all profit in a way, and it's not. It's there to sort of protect against these long-term back-end losses. And I think there's a big danger within the market that that's not really being priced very well at the moment. I think to get access, there's a couple of aspects to get access to home equity, which we will have to do because it's just the dominant source of wealth and we've just got no choice but to somehow find ways of getting access to it. And I think there's a couple of things that it would help if we had something like some protection from the use of that asset against the asset test and the age pension, because that's such a downside to taking equity out. So I think we've got to somehow sort that out. Like, I think we have to cap the home in the age pension test anyway, but we do have to find a way, if people want to release equity, for good purposes, like healthcare costs, that it should still be protected. And I think the other thing too is that one of the risks of people using out the home equity is it is their last financial asset. And so if they adopt a really good behaviour early, you know, good from a country point of view, and say, well, we'll reverse mortgage it, we'll use it to fund our healthcare, we won't sort of take from the system and things like that, then what happens if they live a long time, have to make changes which maybe impact some of the conditions around the reverse mortgage, and they get caught out and are then quite impoverished? And so I think there's some risks for people to use their last financial asset, unless we can somehow think about whether the government programs are sufficient to pick them up, to reward them for using, being prepared to use that asset.
Okay, thanks. I actually think the reverse mortgage providers have been quite conservative and they don't have a lot of risks in Australia. They started off 2 to 3 percent above the home variable interest rate. Competition's got that down to about 100, 120 basis points. But the amounts borrowed are actually quite small. I think if you were 65, they'd only lend you up to 10 or 20% of the value of your home anyway. So there's a bit of protection in the system. I question, though, whether younger people should take these out. There are probably more appropriate products they could use. They might take out a normal mortgage and let their kids pay it off rather than let the house value whittle away. But it is a very long-term product, and it does depend on how housing prices change over time, and there is a bit of uncertainty in that. But most of the lending is done so that the value of the home won't reduce for a very long time.
Have had some experience in trying to price these things. We tried to take an option pricing approach to a reverse mortgage with a no negative equity guarantee a few years ago, and it's actually quite surprising how risky these products are for the providers. You've got a combination of an illiquid asset, so you don't actually know what the volatility of the price is. You can't really motivate it based off sort of normal risk-neutral option pricing approaches. You've got an uncertain expiry date on the option as well. And put those two things together, it actually makes it very, very difficult. And I can certainly understand the providers wanting to be conservative in the way that they price these things for those two reasons. I think what we're seeing innovation in this space is coming back to sort of more bundling of products. And so if you can find a way of putting a few different products together so that the risks are at least diversifying and in some cases offsetting, and at the same time, you know, sort of provide some additional services around, well, rather than you having to go through the hassle of selling the house before you go into a nursing home, which is the last thing you want to be thinking about at that point in time, you can somehow bundle in the home equity as part of the contribution, have an income stream plus a care stream whereby you only take one or the other. So you might take an income stream up to a point and then that income stream stops, you move into care. I think those types of bundling of products is where a lot of innovation is starting to take place there. And if you can link that somehow to home equity, so that it's, you know, you're not having to do a whole bunch of discrete transactions, I think, you know, that's maybe where some of the innovation might be.
Yeah, Andrew Gale, if I can add a few comments on the reverse mortgage side of things. And probably just a bit like Pauline's comment about being excited about the evolution of the new sort of pooling of products. I think one of the interesting and exciting things for actuaries with the reverse mortgages is the contribution which we can make in that space. Certainly, I've been involved in reviewing a number of those which are available in the market, and all those in which I've reviewed have had actuarial modelling sitting behind them. They are complex in terms of the risks, the interaction of the property cycle, the interest rate cycle, and longevity. I think the providers that I'm aware of who get involved in that area are aware of those risks and therefore have had actuarial involvement and contribution in constructing the model sitting behind them. So I dare say some of the risks, I'm not saying that they're straightforward to understand, but I think the providers of those do understand the complexities and have been seeking to get the right sort of advice. On the social security side, I think the issues which emerge there really depend on the extent to which you do lump sum drawdowns versus income drawdowns. So the way things play out for social security purposes does vary, and indeed if you focus more on an income drawdown versus lump sum drawdowns, then some of the social security concerns which have been expressed are largely mitigated. And the final comment was... that's probably it at this stage on the reverse mortgages. So I think they will be an area which will probably evolve strongly, and I think actuaries can make a very good contribution to ensure that they evolve in a robust manner. Sorry, the final point I was going to make is most people think about home equity. One of the other great love affairs Australians have is the second mortgage, the second property, often it might be an investment property of some description or a holiday type property. They also can be accessed, and you know, if you are in retirement and you need access to funds, maybe an alternative to wholesale, you know, sale of that property to support your retirement income needs is actually some more gradual access to the equity which is tied up in those properties.
I might just comment too. Look, I agree that the income withdrawals do work a lot better from Social Security, but one of the things that a lot of providers don't like them as much, because obviously they're not as profitable for them, because giving a loan of $200,000 is a lot more profitable than giving a loan of $1,000 each year for 20 years. It takes them a long time to see a sort of profit margin come back. So, but from the consumer's point of view, I think they're a lot better. And the other obvious way to access home equity is to sell down. You don't necessarily have to mortgage it either.
Yeah, thanks very much. We've reached the end of the panel session, so could we all thank the panel speakers for their contributions.